Welcome to the third episode of Nightmares of a Doctor. In order to maintain the anonymity of the individuals concerned in these stories, names, places, and identifying features have been altered where appropriate. Therefore, any resemblance to individuals living or dead is purely coincidental. Although necessary details have been changed, these stories are based on actual events. They are real tragedies suffered by real people in real hospitals and clinics throughout England and Wales. For hospital workers, the face of death is one you soon learn to recognise. At the very end, everyone surrenders to it. The process of ageing allows a protracted decline, providing an opportunity for a measured adjustment of expectations. But solace is rarely found when death meets with children. The youngest, when faced, will slide towards it too easily. They haven't yet learned what it is that they fight for. They haven't had the opportunity to learn to love life. It is the ones in between who resist most of all. The healthy adults unexpectedly afflicted by a fatal illness. They are the ones who demand immortality. When confronted by death, you can do nothing else but cling to the illusion written in our DNA. Our survivalist instinct persuades us we are special and entitled to our lives. The stark reality is that our importance in the universe is only as good as what we make of each other. We are born into the world, but entitled to nothing. Life is a privilege that we must work to enjoy, because every moment of existence is an inconceivably improbable blessing. And when tragedy strikes, there can be no way but forward until we meet the end. Jane and her family took their share of tragedy. Although desperately heartbroken, they never failed to keep moving forward. Jane stood wearily with the solemn crowd of morning commuters. The sun had not yet risen over the inner city rail station, but already the platform was quietly filling. Flickering white lights cast an unpleasant glare, enhancing the shadows they were supposed to dispel. A mechanical voice welcomed them in as they obediently ordered into rows along the platform, the tips of their toes just behind the yellow line. Unseen overhead, pregnant black clouds gathered silently above them, while the first light of day glowed dimly from the east. The yawning sky woke with a rumble of thunder, unleashing its torrent onto the stirring city below. As one, the rows of smartphones were replaced with umbrellas as the commuters continued their routines unmoved. Jane gazed vacantly into the black morning air, dreading the beginning of her dull working day. But before her mind had the time to properly consider it, the blackness was replaced with the light of her smartphone. It illuminated her face, lightening her expression with the shade of a smile. She pulled her umbrella closer as a heavy lash of rain swept down from above. The platform speakers hissed into life, indifferently announcing the cancellation of her train. Jane waited to hear about alternative travel routes, but with a rasping crackle, the speaker turned off. She looked blankly ahead of her, before swearing at the air. The lines of commuters broke off impatiently. Jane turned around with them and filed onwards hopelessly. She paused to consider where best to go next before a short-legged businessman brushed past her side. The trailing tip of his low-lying umbrella flicked at the phone Jane carried in her hand. The phone spun in the air and bounced along the ground, finishing just inches from the edge of the platform. Jane dashed in its direction against the bustling tide. By the time she had reached the place it had fallen, an unknowing boot had clipped it off the edge. Jane crouched in the rain, clinging to her umbrella. The glow of her phone showed itself in the dark, flawlessly centered between the tracks of the railway. She looked at the announcement board. It showed a list of cancellations, but no incoming trains. A passing commuter stopped in his own tracks, distracted by the woman balanced on the platform's edge. Jane was staring down each end of the tracks. The contour of the platform had an imperceptible curve that bent it around slowly past the sides of the station. Jane studied the darkness, and the stillness reassured her. She folded her umbrella and layered on the puddled ground. Without any hesitation, she gracefully slid from the platform to the tracks. A curious crowd gathered at the spot she had been crouching. Some slowed their pace, others stopped entirely. The sea of wide eyes silently screamed at Jane to come back. Jane picked up her phone and turned around quickly, before a terrible sound cut through the falling rain. Jane froze where she stood, transfixed by the howl of a train bearing down on her. The people on the platform exploded into action, shrieking and waving in warning of the train. A second loud blast broke Jane's disbelief. This time she acted. She leapt towards the sea of outstretched arms, but the freight train came with a frightening speed. Her injuries were catastrophic, but Jane did not die. The immediate collision amputated her arm and shattered much of her remaining skeleton. Dislocated spinal vertebrae transected her spinal cord, breaking all neurological communication with the lower half of her body. Massive internal bleeding caused her heart to stop beating until paramedics on the scene restored her circulation. Their action saved her life, but already a terrible damage had been done. In the absence of oxygenated blood, Jane's organs began to starve, resulting in global and irreversible damage to her brain. She was 26 years old at the time of her accident. Like many young adults, she had hopes and fears, lovers and friends, an invested youth, and a future to look forward to. All of it was taken from her, and the path of her life was tentatively placed on a very different course. For months, she was cared for in an intensive care unit, requiring complex support for multi-organ failure. With time and persistence, her condition improved, and she was discharged home into the care of her parents, Sally and Mike. Jane's parents were faced with a monumental task. Their daughter had been changed beyond all recognition. Unable to speak beyond incoherent grunts. Unable to move beyond twitches and seizures. Difficulty swallowing and doubly incontinent. Jane's needs were demanding as much as they were complex. Her new existence risked a host of new diseases. Her poorly coordinated swallow risked food or drink entering her lungs and forming a pneumonia. Confinement to her bed risked bed sores and clot formation. Unused bones would become fragile and porous, risking osteoporosis and fractures with only minimal exertion. And there was many more besides that made Jane vulnerable. Sally and Mike struggled from the start, emotionally as much as practically. A year had not yet passed when the two determined that they could not provide the care that their daughter needed to live safely. Jane was taken to a care home not far from her parents, to be cared for by professionals who understood what she needed. Sally and Mike visited Jane regularly, but their relationship with the care home did not begin well. On entering the care home, the scent of stale urine was distinctly appreciable, and they were troubled by the inattention of the scarce staff that they saw. Problems such as these are frequently well known to overstretched care homes, but for Sally and Mike, these issues were alarming. Within the first week, Jane had a seizure. Staff were slow to respond to the alarm the parents raised, and it was nearly night by the time the doctor came to review her. Jane slept soundly in her post-ictal state, but already bruises had covered her like a blanket. Sally and Mike felt helpless and unheard. They raised their complaint to the matron in charge, but there was little that could be done to placate the grief-stricken parents. Their relationship with the care home did not improve. Complaints grumbled daily, and the staff began to resent the tension that they brought. Sally and Mike began to look at alternative arrangements, but given Jane's complexity, the options were limited. 18 months passed, but Jane had not been moved. Their efforts to relocate her slipped gradually away into weary resignation. Sally and Mike liked to visit Jane as much as they could. Sally was a teacher, and Mike worked with hotels. They should have been busy enjoying their family and planning for their retirement, but funding Jane's care was a crippling responsibility, and both worked hard to ensure it was kept. On one particular morning, while Sally taught at school, Mike found time to visit his daughter in the care home they had come to accept. He stood by Jane's bed to spoon her a breakfast of yogurt and fruit, before dropping himself heavily into a chair at her bedside. He sat back and closed his eyes, reaching out blindly to hold his daughter's one remaining hand. And in the comfort that it gave him, he found a semblance of peace. As Mike drifted into a brief, dreamless sleep, he missed the expression that was spreading on Jane's face. Her back began to spasm, and she grunted from her bed. Mike mumbled in response, but he did not stir from sleep. Jane lifted her chest and arched her back painfully, quietly emitting a lingering groan. Mike's tired eyes fluttered and opened themselves wearily. There was a momentary pause as Jane sucked in deeply a great breath of air before releasing a deafening and unnatural sound. Jane was screaming. Mike shot up from his chair and looked at his daughter. Her breathing had quickened, and a few seconds passed before she emitted the tortured noise again. Mike looked around frantically, searching for something that might be causing her distress. He looked at her hopelessly as she made the noise a third time. Then he picked up her hand, stroking and kissing it, before dashing out the room to find someone to help. His demands for a nurse were not easily met, but his obvious urgency soon persuaded one to come. They went to Jane together, entering to a silence that reassured the nurse, but only worried Mike more. Jane turned in her bed, looking up at her father, who gratefully smiled at the unusual attention. The nurse frowned irritably and asked him to move at once. She took Mike's place to hold Jane's wrist and feel for her heartbeat. She spoke to Jane kindly, assuring her she was safe and well looked after. Jane lay back comfortably and babbled in agreement. The nurse thrust an oximeter probe onto Jane's index finger and wrapped a blood pressure cuff tightly around her upper arm. She checked all the readings, noting them down into a set of paper notes. Then she turned to Mike, and firmly declared that nothing was amiss. Mike thanked the nurse as she stomped out the room. He sat back down, confused and embarrassed at the fuss he had caused. Once again, he reached out to hold his daughter's hand, but this time, his eyes remained guarded and open. He studied Jane's face, feeling decidedly unsure of himself. She lay in her bed, appearing quite comfortable, but Mike didn't fail to notice the redness of her eyes and the blush of her cheeks. Mike rubbed his own eyes as though it might clear his head. His mind had been addled by 1,000 sleepless nights, and every decision felt muddled with doubt. He leant forward in his chair and held his face in his hands, until something he heard paralyzed him where he sat. His ears twitched like antennae as he silently turned to look towards Jane. Her eyes and mouth were gaping wide open. Her head had turned red, and her body trembled lightly. Jane's eyes were closed, but her mouth remained open as she let out a scream that froze Mike's heart. Once again, he leapt up, patting her hand and soothing her with words while desperately searching for a source to her pain. The nurse was wrong. He had to make her understand that something terrible was happening. He strode to the door and cried out for help. When no help arrived, he took out his phone and photographed his daughter as she thrashed in her bed and screamed out in pain. When the nurse saw the photos, she stared back at Mike with the sudden realization that something was amiss. She handed back his phone as she pushed past him quickly. But when they got back to Jane, she lay peacefully in her bed. This time, the nurse was not so easily reassured, and she carefully reassessed her patient's vital signs. While Jane appeared settled, her heart rate and blood pressure were now creeping up. But the photos alone were more evidence than was needed. Something unusual was happening to Jane. An ambulance was called, and they themselves witnessed an episode of her screaming. They took her to accident and emergency directly to be reviewed by the emergency team. Jordan was a junior doctor working in accident and emergency. He met with Jane and Mike, looked at Jane's readings, and spoke at length with Mike, who carefully explained Jane's medical history. Distress by itself is a non-specific symptom, so Jordan performed a thorough medical examination, which revealed a tenderness and tightness throughout Jane's abdomen. Tenderness in the abdomen is still a relatively non-specific finding, but it gave him something to work on. To complete his assessment, Jordan arranged blood tests, urine tests, and x-rays of her chest and her abdomen. When he had this information, he put Jane on a drip of intravenous fluids to keep her hydrated and maintain her cardiovascular state. Nothing was shown in either of Jane's x-rays, but blood and white blood cells were present in her urine. These findings were suggestive of a urinary tract infection. In addition, her blood tests showed signs of an inflammatory process. The evidence suggested that her immune system was fighting. Although the urine tests were indicative, the source of concern was still unclear. As well as the fluids that were dripped into her veins, Jordan gave her a shot of intravenous antibiotics, which would circulate her body and combat most infections. He presented his case to the consultant on duty, who frowned at Jordan as he took it all in. Here was a 27-year-old female with complex care needs due to a previous hypoxic brain injury. The consultant paused as he carefully considered this. Why should a simple urinary tract infection give a patient cause to scream. He and Jordan went to see Jane. Mike retold his story to them both as the consultant frowned at Jane's fragile form. No further information came from Mike's repetition, but the consultant was convinced that something was still missing. Jordan was tasked with arranging a CT scan with the radiology department. A CT scan of Jane's abdomen and pelvis would produce high-resolution images of the anatomy inside. Few illnesses could hide from CT, and if found to be normal, Jane could be treated on antibiotics alone for an unusual presentation of urinary tract infection. However reasonable this request might have seemed, Jordan would never get a CT scan for Jane, because something unexpected was about to come to light. For all its diagnostic benefits, the main downside of CT is the radiation that it causes, to which younger patients such as Jane are particularly susceptible. For this reason, it is routine protocol that all women of childbearing age who require a CT scan are proven not pregnant prior to scanning. As unlikely as it seemed, Jane was tested according to protocol. The test came back positive. But Jane wasn't just pregnant, she was also in labor. The unimaginable was proven possible, and so the CT was abandoned for the damage it would cause to the unborn child. Jordan was left speechless, and he did not know what to say when Mike asked him to explain the reason for the delay. He informed his consultant, who swiftly involved the on-call obstetric team. 1,000 questions flew around everyone's mind, but the most pressing issue was the safety of the patient. Jane's contractions were accelerating, and with it her pain. Delivering a child is a cognizant process, and one that Jane was not well enough to perform. The decision was simple. Without surgical involvement, Jane would likely die, and so would her child. Jane's mother Sally joined Mike at her bedside, and the doctors advised them on what needed to be done. A decision was made quickly, and an emergency cesarean section was performed. A perfect, healthy baby girl was born, and both of her grandparents were present to meet her. With the health of the baby and mother secured, the grandparents returned to the troubling issue of the newborn's paternity. They would not be alone in uncovering the truth. An experienced safeguarding team was assigned to the task, but even as they began to make preparations for their investigation, new information was yet to come to light. A man named Nigel somewhat proudly claimed ownership of the strange situation, unashamedly declaring himself father of Jane's child. He was a 42-year-old healthcare assistant who had been working at Jane's care home for the previous 6 months. He admitted that a child had not been part of his or Jane's plans, but he insisted on the existence of their mutually consensual sexual relationship. But he claimed more than that. He and Jane were deeply in love, or so Nigel said. Despite his pleas of innocence, the authorities were informed and Nigel was arrested. But the fate of the child's parenthood was not yet resolved. A paternity test showed that despite his admissions, Nigel was not the father. The spotlight was shone on all the remaining male care workers, who all came forward to assist the investigation, all except one. They say guilty people run, and this one ran as fast as he could. A young healthcare worker, aged only 23 years, was arrested at an airport as he made his attempts to exit the country. A subsequent paternity test proved him as the father of Jane's newborn girl. He made no such claims of a consensual relationship. The man was tried and imprisoned for his crimes. It is reasonable to doubt the sincerity of Nigel's claims, but all evidence suggests that Nigel was unaware of any other abuser, as he believed himself involved in a monogamous relationship. While that was what he claimed, he lacked the audacity to accuse Jane of infidelity. Just like the other, he was brought before a court and imprisoned for his crimes. It is right that the rapists were swiftly brought to justice, but it does raise the question of whether Jane's abuse finished with the two of them. A full and thorough investigation was undertaken, which found no reason to suspect that any other was involved. But no one could know what other secrets there may have been, tightly locked in Jane's inaccessible memory. Jane's child was looked after by her grandparents while Jane was transferred to another place of care, far away from the site of her terrible abuse. It was there that her suffering was finally to end. Jane was existing on a gravely damaged brain due to the blood loss that had come from her accident, the resulting cardiac arrest, and oxygen starvation. Most notably, this had damaged an area of the brainstem known as the medulla oblongata. The medulla is a vital center at the base of the brain, responsible for many automatic processes. The unconscious control of breathing and the functioning of the heart are among its many roles. But the medulla is also responsible for swallowing. It may seem the most benign and unremarkable function that all of us do many times every day, but swallowing is actually a complex neurological process demanding well-coordinated muscular control. Should this process falter, anything intended for the stomach may be instead diverted to the lungs. If food, drink, or even saliva misses the signals that are transmitted through the mouth and throat, they may instead be allowed to slip around the epiglottis and find its way down to the bottom of the lungs. Should this happen by chance to a healthy individual, they will be immediately subjected to a reactive cough, which will not stop until the offending item has been cleared from the airways. And what part of the brain is responsible for this cough? That part is also the medulla oblongata. So when Jane happened to swallow fluid into her lungs, there was no signal from her brain instructing her to clear it. It settled in her lungs, gathering microorganisms. Before Jane's daughter had reached her first birthday, Jane had contracted an aspiration pneumonia. She was treated exhaustively by the hospital doctors, but she deteriorated quickly, and nothing could be done to save her shattered life. Her grief-stricken parents gained solace from knowing that Jane's suffering was over. Their scars ran deep, and the death of their daughter had changed them forever. And yet, in their predicament, they were warmed by the presence of their beautiful granddaughter and the knowledge that Jane's memory would continue on through her. These stories deal with themes that will be challenging for some. If you're in need of advice, try to speak to a loved one or someone you trust. If you are still unsure, seek advice from your registered GP, who can refer you on to one of the many available support services. If you or someone you know are dealing with a mental health emergency, you should urgently contact your local crisis support group. Talking costs nothing, but it could be worth everything.